You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 30th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, author of Green is the New Red, Will Potter, on the targeting of environmentalists and animal rights activists as terrorists, as opposed to targeting terrorists as terrorists by the federal government. Also on the program today, GDP down in negative territory for the fourth quarter, attributable to a significant decrease in defense spending. Don't get your hopes up in that regard, but it just goes to show you what happens when governments don't spend, though I'm happy they're not spending in that in defense. President Obama does not release a specific plan yesterday in terms of immigration. We'll talk about that as we speak. Hearings in the Senate on gun control reform. Devastating clip from Gabby Giffords. We'll play later in the program. The Department of Justice, a couple of senators want to know why there have been no investigations into bankers. The Republicans there's pushback. Some anti-abortion groups want them to talk more about rape. Yes. Yes. First up, before we get to the economic stuff and talk to Will Potter, today the Senate, or I guess it was yesterday, the Senate confirmed John Kerry as Secretary of State. He was replaced in Massachusetts. Deval Patrick, Governor Deval Patrick, basically made an appointment to fill Kerry's seat. He chose his former chief of staff, that being Governor Patrick's former chief of staff, Mo Cowan, who has since, I guess, gone into he's a lawyer, works for a law firm. But John Kerry got all but three votes in the Senate in his confirmation hearing. Who is it? Cornyn, Inhofe, and this next guy, Ted Cruz, the newest senator out of Texas. Is that right? And this is what Ted Cruz had to say the other day about John Kerry and nominee Hagel for Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense. I think you'll find this somewhat amusing. This is Ted Cruz speaking at the National Review Institute Forum in D.C. just 3 days ago. Here he is talking about the nominations of these two guys. Oh, here it is. Wait a second.
We have been, at least since World War II, the preeminent voice for freedom, the preeminent voice for peace.
Ooh, well, Okay.
On the globe. That, I think, we must remain. We must remain unapologetically a voice for freedom and peace. You know, if you think about moments in history and dip.
I want to just stop you here. I know a lot of you leftists out there don't want the U.S. government to be the preeminent voice for peace in the globe. But you just have to get on board with that.
Diplomatic moments. Okay, we've got two pending nominations, John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, both of whom are very prominently
anti-us.
Less than ardent fans of the U.S. military.
So says Ted Cruz, who never served in the military, about two guys who did serve in the military. And I think both of them, I don't know if both of them are, but Kerry, I believe, is still carrying shrapnel, right? Is that right? In his leg? So there's the chicken hawk on parade, Ted Cruz, and he was the third vote against John Kerry's nomination. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Will Potter, author of Green is the New Red, and his latest piece, How the Pursuit of Animal Liberation Activists Became Among the FBI's Highest Domestic Terrorism Priorities. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. The author of Green is the New Red, an insider's account of a social movement under siege. He's also, his work has appeared in Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, LA Times, Washington Post, the Vermont Law Review. Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I got to say, your book got some great reviews. Let me just read a line from one of them. Will Potter's new book, Green is the New Red, is as compelling and well-written focus on many cases across the country involving animal and environmental movements. Congratulations on that. Of course, that is from the Federal Counterterrorism Unit that apparently... appreciates your writing.
Well, you know, and unfortunately, we didn't have those documents before the book was published because I thought that would, you know, fit really well on the back cover. But you know, maybe for the next round.
Now, that's there's a bunch of things I want to talk to you about. Not the least of which is the release from prison of Daniel McGowan, who was the subject of a documentary that. We had talked about on this program, I guess, a year or so or more, If a Tree Falls. But let's start first. Let's work backwards from this counterterrorism unit review of your book. Why are federal counterterrorism agents so interested in your book?
Well, it appears through the counterterrorism unit documents we received, they're not just interested in the book, but also had been monitoring lectures I've given at universities, correspondence with people like Daniel McGowan, who at the time was in prison, and other First Amendment activity like publishing my website. And I think it's, you know, a good example of how far all of this has come, that a lot of the pretext of all this surveillance being about criminal activity has really been dropped. I mean, a lot of the surveillance that's being wrapped up in reports like this is First Amendment activity, protest activity, and in my case, I mean, it's just reporting about what is actually happening.
And you wrote your book, I think it came out a little over a year and a half ago, and this was just as, I think, Occupy was beginning. We are well aware of counterterrorism units and federal authorities surveying and surveilling Occupy Wall Street movements. But this has been – that is really sort of an extension of a program that, according to your book, basically started following 9/11. And, I mean, I recall back in 2005 or 6 reporting on a story that the FBI had been investigating vegan protests of some type of ham factory in Georgia and thinking that was an anomaly, but apparently it's not. I mean, take us through Green is the New Red. Well, first, let's start with this. Tell us what that title means.
So the title, Green is the New Red, is referencing what is probably the most notorious era of overly reaching, you know, government repression in U.S. history, of the Red Scare of the 20s and also the 40s and 50s. And by invoking that, I, of course, don't mean that what's going on today is exactly the same as that or that it's worse or anything of the sort. But I just think it's really useful to look at what's happening now, especially with the war on terrorism and how it's being used against dissidents in that historical context. And a lot of those similarities are really too striking to ignore. But what's going on right now, the significant difference is that all of this is originating from corporations. You know, beginning in the early 1980s, corporations actually created this word, eco-terrorism. And over the next 20 years, they used it relentlessly in PR campaigns, sound bites, congressional hearings, legislation, ad campaigns, you name it, to the point where the FBI eventually adopted it as its number one domestic terrorism threat. And that's really how we begin to explain examples like you mentioned down in Atlanta, where activists were surveilled by Homeland Security for passing out leaflets outside of a honey-baked ham store.
Now, you had your own experience with the feds based upon handing out leaflets. And you recount this in your book, but tell us the story, because it's really stunning how aggressive these guys got with you.
So just a few months after September 11th, I was working at the Chicago Tribune covering breaking news, kind of blood and guts, cop shop reporting, and it was leaving me feeling, you know, really dark and depressed. I mean, I wasn't feeling like my journalism had any positive impact on the world whatsoever. So I just decided to go out leafleting. You know, I thought that was the most I could do working full-time as a reporter, is just to hand out some leaflets. I didn't want to go to protests or anything like that. The important part of that story is that we were actually arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. And a few months later, I had a knock on the door by two FBI agents who told me that unless I helped them by becoming an informant and investigating animal rights and environmental groups, that they would put me on the domestic terrorist list. And among the other threats they made were to make sure my girlfriend at the time didn't receive her graduate school funding. I had a Fulbright application pending that I didn't receive. But, you know, you have no idea if that's just because you're not smart enough or because, you know, they actually followed through on some of these threats. So that the impact of that experience was really a turning point for me, and really is why I became so obsessed with finding out how all of this happened. And, you know, how so soon after 9/11 you have FBI agents threatening to put people on terrorism lists for handing out leaflets and being arrested for disorderly conduct for doing that.
I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but these FBI agents, they had clearly investigated every aspect of your life. They knew that your father had guaranteed your lease, that they knew who your editor was. They referenced your editor at the time They clearly were communicating to you, we know all the aspects in your life. If we have to intimidate or derail your girlfriend's career, if we have to intimidate your father or lean on your editor, we will do all those things. So what was your reaction? What happened subsequent to that?
Well, you know, as we were standing there in the alley behind my building, I just had this flash in my head that, you know, I think we all want to think that in experiences like that, when we see and read about things with the FBI happening in other eras during the civil rights movement or with other social movements we respect, I've always wanted to think that you just wouldn't flinch, that it wouldn't affect you in any way. But I was terrified. For all the reasons you described, for the amount of information that they had, for the threats they were making, not just against me, but about my family and my girlfriend and my career. And they made a point of saying that, you know, we know you have your life together. This is some of the language they use. You live in a nice apartment. You know, you live here with your girlfriend. We know you have you're working at the Tribune. We know who your editor is. We know where else you've worked. We know about all these grant applications you have pending to go report overseas. I mean, they knew ins and outs of everything. They knew where my dad worked, how much he was paid, the fact that I had to get him to co-sign on my lease because, I mean, I was straight out of college and, you know, had a hard time getting a lease for an apartment in Chicago. Everything. So, I mean, it really was a chilling experience that lasted. I mean, that fear took a little while to go away. I never thought about becoming an informant in any way, but I really did question what all of this meant and how this was going to affect me and potentially for the rest of my life.
So when you walked away, I mean, what ultimately happened? Did you ever hear from them again? Did you file some type of complaint? I mean, I got to tell you, if that happened to me, I don't know. I honestly don't, you know, aside from, you know, soiling myself, I don't really know if I would be able to function in many respects.
Well, and, you know, I try to be really open about this in the book as well, is that it really made me ashamed that I was so afraid, to the point where I really withdrew from my girlfriend, from my friends, from the other people who were arrested. And, you know, I was really embarrassed by that any of this affected me. So it made me so afraid. But, you know, with time, that, of course, you can pull back a little bit, think a little bit more clearly about it. And that's not to say that I began to see their threats as any less serious, but nothing immediate happened. So in time went on. I moved to Washington, D.C. I got another job covering Congress for a newspaper, and it didn't seem that they made good on a lot of those threats. But like I said, you know, when things happen, I think that's the power of threats like this, especially in that post 9/11 context, is you don't know what it means. You know, when you get delayed at the airport, when you get pulled away for security checks, every time that happened to me, all I was thinking was, oh my God, I'm about to get arrested for something. Oh my God, I'm being singled out because I'm on a terrorist list. And, you know, it's difficult to shake.
And what is the recourse at that point? I mean, you know, the thing is, we hear these stories all the time, and we hear these reports, particularly in the wake of Occupy. We heard of stories of just of cops, of feds showing up at people's houses and just saying, "Hey, we know where you live. We know what you've been doing." Obviously, to have a chilling effect on people's just simply they're protesting, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of institutional recourse here. There's no ombudsman that you go to. There's no inspector, you know, general that you go to. What tends? I mean, you spoke to a lot of people who went through these type of things. What do people end up doing afterwards? Are there any effective means to sort of, I don't know, get this out into the ether? I mean, because in some ways it's sort of shocking that nothing happens after this.
And you're absolutely right. And I was shocked by that as well, that there's truly nothing that could be done institutionally. And I think that's an important point that you mentioned in that language, that, you know, through proper channels, there is no way to get your name off of no-fly list. There is no way of going about these things. I mean, you can file Freedom of Information Act requests, which I'm still attempting to get years later. But that being said, I turned to other recourse. I mean, I became really focused on raising awareness about these issues, not just about my story, because I think what I experienced is really a drop in the bucket compared to what so many people I write about in the book have endured. I mean, have actually faced and gone to prison, been sentenced to prison as terrorists, have had extreme surveillance and harassment and things like this. So to me, it just made me want to work that much harder to actually expose what's taking place.
There's a quality of what, or at least I get, I would draw an analogy to the redefinition of people who are engaged in protests. And we should say that you make a point in your latest piece that the West Point terrorism, I guess there's a terrorism institute at West Point that has documented hundreds of cases of right-wing domestic terrorism that has led to fatalities, that has led to injuries over the past 20 some odd years, none of which, but none can be said the same for who they label as eco-terrorists or animal rights terrorists. Yet there seems that following 9/11, it's almost as in the same way that the analogy I'm drawing here is the shock doctrine, that there are these ideas that are floating around there, that they're being pushed in this instance by corporations that are simply waiting for an opportunity for them to take hold. Is that a reasonable explanation of what seemed to happen after 9/11?
I think that's an excellent way of putting this in a bigger context. I mean, I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with this idea of the shock doctrine, and especially how Naomi Klein articulates it, of exactly that, of people having not just tools, but an ideology and a tactic that's waiting for the prime opportunities to go about it. And that's essentially the thesis of my work as well, as when you begin to chart the history of how all of this has happened, like I said, since the early 1980s, you see that it was not an outgrowth of September 11th. It did not spring from September 11th. It really just accelerated because of that. And I think looking at this through the lens of that shock doctrine is really how you explain that all of these tactics were waiting. I mean, they already had developed legislation. This Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a new federal law passed after 9/11, had been attempted many years before that. But the new opportunities and the new fear that was created by the terrorist attacks in New York really offered substantial opportunities to push things even further.
And so one of the drivers behind this legislation, at least on a state level, was and maybe remains ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Committee, I guess it is, or Legislative Action Committee, which we've talked about on this program. But give us a sense of where these laws and where these definitions, where they were generated and how they were adopted. Because, you know, to go from, you know, the idea that, I don't know, the honey-baked ham people want the rest of society to perceive anybody who's protesting them as some form of terrorists, to FBI agents adopting this seems bizarre in some respects.
Absolutely. And I think the legislative changes were incremental. In every step of the way, the people behind it were some of the most powerful corporations on the planet. At the federal level, with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, internal documents that I obtained that were not available to lawmakers or to the public showed the list of corporations that were heavily involved in lobbying and actually drafting parts of this legislation. They include Pfizer, Wyatt, GlaxoSmithKline, you know, the big pharma companies, also big ag corporations like Cargill, even circuses like Ringling Brothers. All those corporations were heavily involved in this. At the state level, we see that as well with, as you mentioned, ALEC, the corporate front group that also was behind the union busting legislation in Wisconsin and the Stand Your Ground legislation, for instance, in Florida. They also have a model Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act. And this model legislation is so broad that it actually labels explicitly nonviolent civil disobedience as acts of terrorism. It creates a eco-terrorist registry for environmental activists that's much akin to a sex offender registry. And it has clauses that not only go after activists, but anyone who is materially supporting them through websites and through endorsing in any way or defending their activities. I would argue for activities like we're engaging in right now, raising questions about this. That's how broadly that's written. So every step of the way, these corporations have really been key to drafting this legislation and lobbying for its approval.
And from a broader strategic sense, let me ask you this. When you talk to, I mean, and I know that you've talked to, at the very least, you've quoted some former FBI agents who have gone on to work for the ACLU. But when you talk to, I mean, give me your sense of the actual agents. I mean, you know, I would imagine that most FBI agents just sort of dispositionally are not terribly amenable to people they perceive to be environmentalist, you know, or animal rights advocates or whatnot. Now, maybe that's just my own sort of prejudice there, but I'm making a generalization. But it seems to me there's a long step to go from, yeah, I'm an FBI agent. I was on the whatever beat it was. I was on the international terrorist beat, or I was on the beat of right-wing domestic terrorists like Timothy McVeigh, or people who are bombing abortion clinics, or hate groups, and I got moved to basically monitoring people who are protesting Keystone XL. What are these FBI agents? I mean, how do they justify in their own minds, if you have a sense, that they are being so heavy-handed in pursuing people who have no history, even as a movement, of actually physically harming other people?
And that's a question I've really struggled with, because I think it's pretty complicated. You know, at the personal level, the FBI agents, for the most part, I don't think have a lot of interaction with environmental and animal rights activists or anarchists, you know, the groups that are really being targeted heavily, Occupy activists. So that allows much of this to proceed more quickly and forcefully, because, you know, when you don't interact with people like this, and then the unknown is being demonized, you know, that whole process becomes much easier. Institutionally, of course, the FBI does not really tilt to the left. Historically, the FBI has a pattern of abuses targeting social movements, civil rights activists, anti-war activists, of course, during COINTELPRO in the 1960s. So I think we have to consider both of those things, but also consider the institutional pressure that is put on individuals. The message is quite clear, especially since 9/11, that the path to career advancement within the FBI and also to a degree state and local law enforcement is by targeting terrorism. One former FBI agent that I spoke with put it this way. She said, you know, in the 80s, in the war, it was the war on drugs. In the 90s, it was gangs. Now it's terrorism. The priorities are quite clear that if you want to get ahead, you have to go along, you know, you have to play the game to some degree. And so I kind of go back and forth. I think all of those things play a role for everyone involved in the FBI to a different extent. But we can't really underestimate to me, the most important is this institutional pressure, because these policies are really coming from the top down.
How did the sort of the labeling of these activities sort of as terrorism happen? I mean, you know, the word terrorism, it seems to me, is problematic. Whether you're talking about the war on terror, whether you're talking about, drone strikes and signature strikes, and the definition of basically terrorists is anybody who gets hit by a drone on some level. But how is it that the word was sort of mutated in such a way that it now covers, leafleting?
And that was something I don't have to depth in the book, is trying to come to actually working definition of the word, because that's one obstacle I hit immediately in this research, is that there is no definition. Even within the U.S. government, different federal agencies have different definitions. State governments have different definitions. The United Nations has no one agreed upon definition of terrorism. And it really hits home to me that the true power of this word is its fluidity.
Right.
It can be molded and modeled to fit whatever the needs and the enemy of the hour actually is. And I think that's the real danger of it. That, you know, since September 11th, I think some most immediate fallout obviously was against Muslim communities who were hit the hardest and in a lot of ways still are targets of this harassment and war on terrorism investigations, entrapment cases. But the power of that language is it can just be molded and adopted by corporations as well, to the point where we now have new legislation being introduced around the country that is targeting not people who are burning buildings, not people who are attempting to murder or fly planes into towers or anything like that, but people who are taking video cameras onto the factory farms and documenting animal welfare violations. In some cases, corporations are attempting to label that as acts of terrorism. And that's really the danger of all of this, how manipulated it can be.
I mean, the word has taken on such a it's such an Orwellian term, because it's just sort of a catch-all phrase for anyone that the establishment does not appreciate in some way. I think it's the Homeland Security chief in Pennsylvania. I think it was, or maybe it was New Jersey, but I believe it was Pennsylvania when he was, there was monitoring of people who were going to see a screening of Gasland. Josh Fox is, just tell us about that, because, you know, I've had Josh Fox on this program multiple times. We've talked about the movie. I've watched the movie. It was an Oscar nominated documentary, yet
right.
it is being used as a device in which, you know, some type of honey trap.
Exactly. And it was a fantastic film, too. I mean, I'm sure your listeners have seen it. It was incredibly well done, Oscar nominated. I think this case is a really good example of the power of what I would call these mercenary corporations or third-party corporations that are springing up in order to evaluate and to highlight terrorism threats. So the way this happened in Pennsylvania is the state Homeland Security Director, James Powers, hired these counterterrorism corporations to evaluate what terrorism threats existed in the state. And those reports came back with a lot of not very surprising information, because when you hire corporations, you pay them tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, to identify terrorism threats. They identify a lot of terrorism threats.
Right.
You know, you get your money's worth. So they identified animal rights activists protesting the use of carriage horses. They identified these film screenings of the movie Gasland. And it was all written up in these dossiers that are then used to shape law enforcement response in the state to acts of terrorism and shape Homeland Security policy. And now, at the same time, this guy James Powers had been quoted in the press when he was asked about the threat of right-wing groups and asked about acts like the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. He actually responded that he didn't think Timothy McVeigh was a terrorist. He was, quote, just very angry with the U.S. government. I mean, this is the I don't think it could get any more stark, the disparity we have right now. Blowing up a building and killing hundreds of people is angry with the U.S. government. Attending a film screening is a potential terrorism threat.
That's just flabbergasting. I mean, is that guy still the chief of Homeland Security in Pennsylvania?
No, fortunately, he was outed not too long after that, but more due to political disagreements rather than scandal related to this.
I mean, that's just stunning stuff. And there's no reason to believe that mentality is not still sort of permeating at the very. I mean, I shudder to think that somebody doesn't think that Timothy McVeigh was not a terrorist. But I would imagine that the that mentality still exists. I mean, you know, Gasland, that screening was probably a year ago. I mean, this is not there's no ebb to this, right? I mean, this seems to me to be just gathering more steam. And when you mention, I just want to go back to when you mention these private companies, it occurs to me, I can't remember now, but I guess it was about 6 to 8 months ago, maybe it was a year ago, there was a lot about, I think Anonymous had hacked into one of these private sort of counterterrorism organizations that had been investigating journalists and sort of the left in general. I seem to remember sort of like Glenn Greenwald's name showing up in these dossiers and others. And I presume this is just a massive industry. And of course, like you say, when you're a hammer, everything's got to be a nail.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of to your question of whether there's an end in sight, I mean, really the reason I focus so much of my effort on these issues is it's not just about animal rights and environmental activists or, you know, the people I talk about in the book or what we've talked about on the program today. I mean, the real danger of all of these tactics is the precedent that they set and how all of this is becoming normalized. You know, it's been 10 years since 9/11, and I think all of your listeners will remember that, you know, after the September 11th attacks, there was still outrage about the Patriot Act. I mean, people were questioning this. People were trying to oppose it. They were shocked that it was passed in the middle of the night. All of that's really fallen by the wayside now. Opposition to Guantanamo. The Obama administration just announced it was closing the unit that was actually tasked with shutting down Guantanamo. All of this is really just becoming institutionalized and normalized so that whether or not it's environmental or animal rights activists being targeted, there will be another group coming down the pike. There's targeting of people perceived as being anarchists right now in the Northwest. We've talked about Occupy Wall Street. I mean, these tools are really, as you said, kind of in the context of the shock doctrine, a toolbox that can be exploited at the best opportunity against other movements.
And you know, it occurs to me as you say that the prosecution and the prosecutorial zeal involved in Aaron Swartz's case is an extension. It appears to me is an extension of that same premise where you have corporate interests are elevated to the point where anyone engaging in anything that is in any way perceived to be a threat to corporate hegemony over information or in certain areas of our culture is elevated as to, you know, Aaron Swartz, who downloads too many academic journals and breaks a term of a service agreement, is, you know, someone who has to go to jail for anywhere from 6 months to 30 years.
Well, and to kind of think of this in another way also, historically, academics and kind of more left social movements in general have talked about these things with phrases like state repression. And I would argue what's going on right now is really shifting to a corporate repression. I mean, the government is clearly a really important player in all of these cases, Aaron Swartz's case in particular, that harassment that he continued to receive from prosecutors, for instance. But at the same time, this is a corporate model, so we have to understand it in the context of these prosecutors and the state more broadly just really being surrogates and intermediaries between corporations protecting their agenda and the people who are being targeted. And to me, that's really in a lot of ways, the most terrifying about this is it's not that the government has become overly powerful and in this 1984 sense of becoming a tyrannical regime. It's that they've merely become puppets in a lot of ways of enacting policies to protect corporate interests and to vigorously enforcing them.
Give me your sense of how we break that connection, because I think I agree with that assessment, and it's. You know, it is such a massive process that gets from, you know, some corporation paying money to go to an ALEC, you know, convention or whatever it is, conference, proposing legislation that criminalizes what amounts to people wanting to boycott their product in some fashion, or even threatening the sales of their product by affecting our culture, to an FBI guy knocking on your door because you're handing out leaflets. Give me your sense of if there is a an inflection point, if there is, or how one fights back against something like this.
Well, I think when talking about things like this, it's really easy to feel powerless. I mean, especially for me, ALEC is a really good example of that. I mean, these corporations are literally drafting the laws in ways that we will never have an opportunity to do as everyday people. We will never have that kind of a voice. But I think we have to remember that the reason these movements are being targeted is because they've been incredibly effective. To me, it's really inspiring to see, for instance, the work of undercover investigators who spend a couple hundred dollars on video equipment and have completely changed the national dialogue about factory farming to the point where corporations are absolutely terrified of these tactics and are introducing legislation to try to stop them. I mean, similarly with the tar sands campaign and the Keystone XL blockades, the corporate backlash against activists using civil disobedience and nonviolent tactics, I think, is really a reflection of the power and the vibrancy of those movements. I think it's easy to feel powerless, but in a lot of ways, we should draw power from that, from the fact that it has instilled so much fear in powerful industries from really grassroots groups. And if they're that afraid now of what people are doing, imagine how terrified it could be if more people were active and more people were taking part in these movements.
Well, Will Potter, author of Green is the New Red, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. We'll have a link up to your book, which is highly recommended by counterterrorism officials who have been apparently monitoring a lot of your work. So, congrats.
Well, thanks, Sam. It's great talking to you.
Okay. Will Potter, folks. We got to take a break. When we come back with the better half of the program, we will talk about the latest GDP numbers. We will play this clip from Gabby Giffords, which basically is her entire testimony today in front of the Senate. Also, this letter written by two senators, bipartisan letter, I should add, sort of stemming out of that documentary that we spoke to Elliot Spitzer about last week, The Untouchables, on the fact that it really appears the Department of Justice, never mind didn't bring any charges, they didn't do much investigation, it would seem, into the massive fraud involved in the financial meltdown. Also, a heartwarming story of assisted living in Britain. and just my thoughts on where immigration reform may be headed. All that and more in the better half of the program. You can be a part of that by calling 646-257-3920. You know, I'd love to hear from a libertarian. You know, here's the amazing thing that occurs to me as I was going through and prepping for this interview with Will Potter. Of the literally tens, if not hundreds at this point, of libertarian phone calls that we receive in the better half of the program, by self-identified libertarians, in the debates that I've had with libertarians like that Stefan Malieu, I never, ever, 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 not once have heard a single libertarian, when they talk about government power, mention, hey, it's a problem that the FBI is knocking on people's doors. I mean, when you talk about government being too big or too powerful, this is the problem. It's not that, hey, they're taxing us and providing services like keeping planes from crashing or trying to keep salmonella out of our meat. It is when you talk about government overreach, this should be the concern. It is stunning to me that I have never heard a single libertarian who's called this program ever mention that.
A lot of these small government conservatives love the police state unless it comes to the Second Amendment. Then they start talking about how they need to take down the police.
Right. Of course. That's just target practice.
When it comes to protests, though, whenever there's a video of a protester getting, like, abused by police brutality, they're always the first to laugh about it and say, yeah, hit them again. Yeah.
It's just bizarre to me. I mean, it's just bizarre to me. And I would think at one point, one libertarian would call in and say, well, surely, Sam, you're not happy about the FBI investigating so-called eco-terrorists or vegans. And my answer would be, of course. But I mean, but it's just bizarre that this so-called libertarian movement, I guess, Alec Jones, to a certain extent, complains about that, but it's always, you know, Agenda 21 or they're coming to take away our vehicles or whatever it is. I mean, it's just bizarre. I don't know. It's just bizarre. But we'll talk more about that.
But they will discuss their freedom to pollute whatever local body of water is next.
Right. I mean, come on, Sam. Our freedoms are being taken away. I can't find the same selection of incandescent light bulbs that I used to at Lowe's.
I really appreciate that because I was – psychically trying to send you a message to get the light bulbs.
As right.
A perfect thing to bring up
right
now.
Our freedoms are taken away when we only have 17 different options on incandescent light bulbs, and then I'm force-fed these LEDs or these fluorescent bulbs. The light's so harsh. My liberty is being stolen.
I also personally don't believe in slavery, but...
Right.
When you get into this whole idea of threatening to destroy people's careers because of leafleting, that's complex. But let's get simple here. Light bulbs.
Right. That's what
the future of America.
Tomorrow I will be down in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA conference talking healthcare with, at the very least, we'll have Wendell Potter on the program. I may have some interviews that I will have done in the morning that I may run. I'm not quite sure what tomorrow is going to look like. And then on Friday, back to regularly scheduled programming. Folks, if you want to support this program, and I hope you do, you can support this program by becoming a member today. I say this every day. I don't do the desperate pleas that I used to because those didn't seem to be effective. But the non-desperate pleas don't seem to be terribly effective either. I mean, sometimes. Some days we get three new members, but other days we don't. And, you know, multiple times during a week I get an email from somebody who's lost their job or whose spouse has lost their job or they have been... they have been afflicted with a medical problem and they need to step back from from their membership. And it is heartbreaking to me that they feel bad about it. I mean, that they feel they have to apologize to me for those misfortunes that have happened to them. So if you are lucky enough to have the resources where you can afford 30 cents a day for this program, whether you're interested in the extra 50 minutes or not that we give you on a daily basis, sometimes more, sometimes, well, rarely less, but sometimes, then please become a member. You're supporting the program not just for yourself, but for other people who can't afford to support it. So you can become a member today at majority.fm. Click the link up top, become a member. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You can IM me at Majority FM on your IM clients. And like I said, 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to, I don't know, give me a suggestion for what I should name my kid or more importantly, talk about some of the issues we've been talking about today. All right, we'll be back in a minute.